Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Ben Edwards with You're the Cure. Thank you for joining us today. We have an exciting show. We've got another guest that I'm super excited about. I've read books for a number of years, and it was really foundational. These books were foundational in my opening my eyes to some new thinking in the realm of science, and really helped to establish my faith. As most of our long-term listeners know, I'm a believer, a professing Christian. Grew up in the First Baptist Church, Belton, Texas, and went to church all my life. But as I got into higher education, evolutionary theory came into play, and really ultimately ended up weakening my faith and my foundation. Brought a lot of questions more than anything, and really shook my ability to have a firm faith in the Bible, or even the possibility of that the Bible could even be true. So again, as the listeners of the show know, the four pillars at Veritas are nutrition, hydration, movement, and peace. And I believe the body's physiology was designed to mostly be in that peace mode as opposed to stress, fight or flight mode. It's very, very difficult to help a patient get well and address these root causes when they're in fight or flight mode. You can only eat and exercise and hydrate yourself so far on your journey to wellness if you're not at peace. And the search for peace isn't just trying to do some positive thinking or stress relief techniques or even try to control all your circumstances. It really moves into the spiritual realm, in my opinion. And oftentimes when we start talking about the spiritual realm with patients, that's where we can lose people a little bit. And I believe a big part of that is because most of us were raised under this teaching of evolutionary theory that Charles Darwin proposed. And most people, I think if you go out on the street and poll them, will think that Charles Darwin's theory of evolution is fact, and it's bulletproof, and it's well proven, and every scientist believes it. And in fact, that's not true. So today's show is to help develop this understanding that there's a possibility that naturalism, materialism, Darwinism may not be the truth, and that there is room for spirituality and room for intelligent design and something outside of what we can see and touch and feel and taste and our five senses. So Dr. Michael Behe is with us today, and he's a professor of biological sciences at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. Also, he's a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. He received his PhD in biochemistry from the University of Pennsylvania in 1978. And his current research involves delineation of design and natural selection in protein structures. He's authored over 40 technical papers, 3 books, which I highly recommend: Darwin Devolves, The Edge of Evolution, and Darwin's Black Box. All 3 are excellent. So y'all check those out. And Dr. Behe has a website, Michael Behe, that's B's and boy, E-H-E.com. Dr. Behe, welcome to the show today. Thank you for being with us.
Sure. Thanks very much for having me. Looking forward to our talking.
All right. Well, you're very welcome. I'm excited to dive into this. I think it's really going to be impactful for a lot of my listeners and patients. Before we kind of get into your books and your thoughts and your research, can you just give a little bit of background, let the listeners know kind of where you came from and kind of what how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, sure. Let's see. I'm a Pennsylvanian. I born and grew up in Pennsylvania and work here still at Lehigh University. And I was born into a Roman Catholic family, and I've been Catholic my whole life. But we were taught Darwin's theory in parochial school. I went to parochial school and told kind of a theistic evolutionary view that, well, God is in charge of nature, and if he wanted to use the laws of nature to make life, well, who were we to tell him otherwise? And that was okay with me, and I didn't give much thought to it. But later on, I went off to school and got a PhD in biochemistry, and biochemistry studies the molecular foundation of life. And when you study that, you come across some really, really elegant and complicated systems, and quite literally machines, molecular machines. And I used to read about those in my graduate student days, and I thought, wow, holy moly, I wonder how that evolved. And I would say, well, I guess somebody knows, and I turned the page. But then in the mid-80s, I read a book called Evolution, a Theory in Crisis by a medical doctor and geneticist named Michael Denton. And he pointed out lots and lots of problems for Darwin's theory that I had never thought of before, and for which I didn't have any answers. And I went to the science library to see if anybody had published answers, and turns out no one had. And at that point, I got mad because I thought I was being taught to believe something, not because of the evidence, but because that's the way we were supposed to think these days. And from that time on, I've become very interested in the topic of evolution, especially at the molecular level, the level of biochemistry. And I quickly came to the conclusion that a mind and intelligence is necessary to explain the complex functionality that we find at the molecular level of life. And so I wrote some books about it and have been speaking about it these past 25 years or so.
Awesome. Can you go back a little bit and kind of give the audience some perspective? Historically, scientists pre-Charles Darwin, many famous scientists were believers, were Christians. I think maybe even almost all of them just assumed or believed there was a design. But can you give some historical perspective to what people just assume back then versus what scientists kind of just assume now? Like you said, you had assumed that someone had figured this out.
Well, it turns out pretty much ever since recorded history, back with ancient Greeks, people thought that life and the universe at large was designed. You know, there were some skeptics, but by and large, that was the natural conclusion of people. And there were Greeks who wrote, well, why do we think there is design? Because, you know, all of these wonderful things are in place, and they need to be in place for life. And when there was a Roman physician named Galen, who was in, I think, the first or second century after Christ was born, and he wrote about all of the marvels of the human body and the eye and so on, and he says the intricacy of all this, you know, bespeaks intelligent design. And that's pretty much the way it was all the way up until the Enlightenment, when more and more scientists, more and more people were interested in science, and lots of exploration was going on, and people noticed that some organisms were similar to other organisms, and a lot of their body parts corresponded and so on. And an idea was floated that perhaps there was this great ladder of life, that maybe even some ancient organisms gave rise to modern organisms. And there were a lot of ideas, but all of these were, the people proposing them always thought they were teleological processes. They were guided or somehow placed into nature. Nobody thought that these were accidental or that chance had much of a role to do in the structure of life. And that was until Charles Darwin came along. So Charles Darwin's claim to fame is not that he proposed, you know, simple evolution, what we might call mere evolution, that organisms today are descended from organisms in the distant past. You know, these other people had thought of that before him. Now, his importance, both scientifically and philosophically, was his theory that this could be explained completely by unintelligent, unguided, non-teleological processes, random variations, and natural selection. So that if some change just happened to come along and happened to improve the chances of an organism to survive, well, just statistically, it was more likely to survive and leave offspring. And if the offspring inherited that trait, then it would start to spread in the population. And so he thought that process, that random process, with no guidance whatsoever from the outside, could explain all of life. And it's interesting that when he first proposed it, it set off a sensation, but not so much because of his particular claim to fame, his idea of how that could happen, but just the idea that organisms are related. And that the very possibility that science might be able to explain some of these, much of the structure of life, kind of got ingrained in scientists' minds. And although they didn't subscribe to Darwin's theory, at least for 70 or so years after he wrote his book, they nonetheless thought there must be some unintelligent explanation that falls completely within the domain of science. So from being orthodoxy that, you know, it was obvious that life was designed before Darwin, now it's orthodoxy that life must not have been designed, because we're just not allowed to think that these days.
Right. Well, can you talk about some of the things that Darwin was observing? And I like to remind people, science really is just the observation of what's going on in nature. And down to the cellular and now subatomic levels, but it's this observation. And we can make predictions and guesses and theories about stuff, and then we go observe and see, was our guess right? So what were the things that Darwin was observing and that he ended up writing about that caused him to think this way?
Well, he saw a number of things. As your listeners may know, Darwin, when he was 23 years old, signed on to a voyage, an exploring voyage, on the HMS Beagle. And this was the age of great explorations, when Europeans were sending out ships to see what the rest of the world looked like. Nobody had much of an idea. And so Darwin was the ship's naturalist, and went on a voyage through South America and into the Galapagos Islands and onto Australia and so on. And one thing he saw was that the animals and plants of small islands off the coast of continents, such as I think there's one called Tenerife, off the coast of Africa, and the Galapagos off the coast of South America, the organisms on those islands strongly resembled the plants and animals of the nearby continent, not each other. And in a strange set of reasoning, I don't know, he said, well, if I were the creator, if I were God, thought Darwin, paraphrasing here, you know, I would have made organisms that were fit exactly for their environment. So if I had a small island off the continent, I'd make them similar to species in other small islands off of other continents. But because they look like the ones on the continent, well, they probably just descended from those. And that's a recurrent problem with science these days and with talking about evolution, and that is that people kind of base their opinions too much on what they think God would or would not have done. And if they decide that, well, God wouldn't have made the animals of Tenerife any different from those of the Galapagos Islands, that's a theological argument. It's not a scientific one. So that was one of the bigger ideas, and in particular the notion of what's come to be called biogeography, that is the distribution of animals and plants. And he saw that there were some similar species on the borders of species that he was studying, and he kind of thought, well, maybe they're related and maybe they became separate a long time ago in the past when they wandered away from the founding species and encountered different conditions. And one of the big examples that he impressed him, he found on the Galapagos Islands, which are about 500 miles west of the South American country of Ecuador. And he saw that there were mockingbirds on those islands and that they differed from each other. There were a couple different looking mockingbirds, and each island seemed to have a separate species. And they were all separate from the single species of mockingbird that occurred in South America. And that got him to thinking that, well, maybe in the distant past, some mockingbirds were blown to this distant island by a storm, perhaps. And there over time, they adjusted to the conditions of the separate islands, and that led to the species that he observed. So those are some of the major observations. He was seeing things that nobody had seen before in the history of life because Western civilization was able to explore things in the 1800s. And he saw variations on themes that he was familiar with and that occurred in different geographies. And so that kind of prodded him into developing his theory of natural selection, common descent, powered by random changes and natural selection.
Okay. So would it be fair to say that basically, and we might need to define natural selection, but that basically there are pressures, there are environmental factors, whether it be the weather, you know, if it's real cold or real hot or humid or the availability of different food species, you know, food products. There's certain, you know, we'll talk about the birds, you know, the shape of a beak. If a beak was long and skinny versus short and blunt, you know, if the food source that was available for the long, skinny beak was more prone to that type of bird being successful in getting food, obviously that bird would thrive and the short, blunt beak would not thrive and maybe even die off. So the environmental pressures naturally select for certain traits in an animal.
Yeah, that's true, and that's what was behind Darwin's idea that maybe if there's the environment changes a little bit, maybe it gets colder or something, then an animal, say, that was born with a thicker fur. Would tend to be able to survive better in such an environment. And if the weather had not been colder, then the animal with the thicker fur would not have any advantage, might even have a disadvantage if it, say, took more energy to grow a thicker coat. But when the change of the environment, that animal would be favored and its offspring would be favored. And so changes in the environment would drive changes in the population to ones that were more adapted to the colder weather. And yeah, on his voyage to the Galapagos Islands, as I mentioned a couple minutes ago, he saw these mockingbirds, but he also collected other birds that he didn't really know what they were. And he took those samples back to England when he returned and gave them to an ornithologist to identify. And the ornithologist said that they were all finches. They were all variations of finches, but Darwin had thought they were blackbirds and sparrows and other things because they seemed different from each other, fairly different from each other. And these birds have been studied recently in the past 50 years or so, particularly by a husband-wife team of scientists from Princeton University. Their names are Peter and Rosemary Grant. And they've been down to the Galapagos, and they saw that there was a drought in one year in the 70s, and the population of a certain species of finch contained a mixture of birds that had longer, thinner beaks and shorter, thicker beaks. And the ones with the shorter, thicker beaks were able to eat the tough seeds of the few plants that survived the drought. But the birds with the longer, thinner ones could not, and they died off. And pretty much half of the population of that species died in the drought, almost all the thinner-beaked birds, leaving behind the thicker-beaked birds. So this was got a lot of recognition as kind of the first example of evolution in action, and it seemed to confirm Darwin's ideas. And I actually write about that in my newest book, Darwin Devolves, that observation, while it was interesting, it left open the question of what exactly was going on in the finches' bodies that led one to have a longer, thinner beak versus shorter, thicker beak. And it's only been in the past 10 years that techniques have been developed that allow scientists to determine the exact mutations, the changes in the DNA that are responsible for the changes in the body structure of the birds. And it turned out that the mutation was one that damaged the ability of a pre-existing gene to produce a factor that made beaks kind of longer and thinner. It was a factor involved in facial development. And with the damaged gene, the beak couldn't develop as it normally did, and it developed kind of shorter and thicker. And just by luck, that was a helpful trait in the drought. But the point I make in the book is that that's interesting and it's important biologically, but it was evolution due to the breaking of a gene that was already there. It was not building a gene. And the big question for biology is not how do you break something, but it's how do you construct all of the phenomenally complex systems that living things contain, the bodies of living things contain. So that's pretty much how the environment affected at least that species.
Right. So am I following you right that these mutations, these gene mutations, are degrading information or breaking down information and function? Do mutations ever gain function or gain information?
If they do, nobody has identified it yet.
Right.
I should emphasize again to the listeners that it turns out that Darwin's theory he proposed the theory, and everybody liked it, and they could see things like the finches surviving in a different environment and so on. So it's the evidence, as far as people could tell, supported Darwin's theory. But ultimately, we have to judge how much this mechanism that he proposed of random mutation and natural selection, how much it can explain at the molecular level of life. Because mutations, which are the kind of fodder for natural selection to select, mutations are changes in molecules. They're changes in the sequence of bases in DNA, the sequence of letters in DNA, and the genes of DNA code for, they are the instructions for the machinery of the cell to make proteins. And proteins, although most people think of proteins as something you eat, they're actually the components of the molecular machinery that helps the cell to run, or that allows the cell to run. And a mutation in the DNA will produce a somewhat different protein, which gives you a machine that might have different properties. And so that's how we now know that evolution would have to work. But the problem is that proteins and the genes that code for them are very complicated things, and they're not just single components. And when you make a change in a complex system, it's much easier to break that machine than it is to improve its function. And what we're seeing these days, now that science has the ability to track down the mutations that are behind some of the improvements that natural selection has selected, is that the large majority of them are like that gene in the finches, that mutations that break or degrade genes that were already there. They aren't ones that are on their way to constructing some new and complicated molecular machine. And let me just mention that we just talked about the effect of weather or the environment on evolution. And one example that Darwin did not write about in Origin of the Species, but has been pointed to by evolutionary biologists since him, is the polar bear. And polar bears are supposed to be descended from brown bears, grizzly bears, over the past few hundred thousand years or so. And now that it's so easy for scientists to determine the exact sequence of letters in the genome of organisms, some groups sequence the entire DNA complement, the entire genome of the brown bear and also of the polar bear, just because they wanted to see what mutations were most important in helping the polar bear adapt to its environment. And they saw that the most highly selected one, the most important one, was a gene for a protein that was involved in pigmentation, in coloring the brown bear's fur brown. And when it was broken, then the fur of the polar bear would have a lot less pigment in it and would be white. And that certainly helped it adapt to the Arctic, where the background is always white. But again, it's breaking a gene. It's not building it. And so far, and I've looked pretty closely, I have not seen any examples of significant gains in genetic information by Darwin's mechanism. Just a lot of losses, degradation. But the interesting thing, now we know that breaking genes can sometimes help, like it did with the polar bear and did with the finches. So strangely enough, it seems that now we can say that Darwin's mechanism is actually powerfully devolutionary, in the sense that it gets rid of genetic information, and sometimes that helps an organism to survive. But it's not building the kind of machinery that science has discovered at the molecular level of life.
Right, which is going to be required, especially when you talk about the big evolutionary concept of moving from one, you know, from a, I don't know, an ant to a butterfly to a rabbit to a human being. There's a tremendous amount of information and molecular machinery required to move from one type of animal to another. So to see that all these various mutations de-evolve, and like you said, could benefit the animal or the insect, but it is a breaking of genes that devolves the species, doesn't elevate the species.
Exactly. Another example of that that kind of many people are probably more familiar with than polar bears and Galapagos finches is dog breeds. It turns out, you know, their dog breeds have been pointed to by evolutionists for a long time because they say, look at the many different changes you can get over a relatively short period of time. Dogs were bred maybe just in the past few hundred years into the varieties we see today. They say, look at all you can get over a relatively short period of time, so that if in nature, you know, the dogs or wolves had to change, then, you know, we can see that selection would be able to change them into all sorts of different varieties.
Right.
And that's true, and it was an important point, but about 10 years or so ago, maybe 15, scientists became interested in looking at the DNA of the different dog breeds simply because they wanted to see how they did, in fact, it was possible to give rise to these many different breeds. What mutations were selected by the breeders, not by nature, but by the breeders, to make a Chihuahua versus a Great Dane and a French Poodle versus a Mexican Hairless or the many different types. And turns out that the mutations responsible for the largest categories of changes are ones that, again, degrade pre-existing genes. So that if you want a dog with curly hair, a certain type of keratin gene, which is used in hair growth, can be damaged and broken. If you want a dog that is much more muscular than other dogs, it turns out you can destroy a gene called myostatin, which tells the body when it's normally time to turn off the growth of muscles. And if that's turned off, then the apparatus which makes muscles kind of shoots past where it's supposed to be, and you get this heavily muscled dog. If you want a Chihuahua, you can break genes involved in the growth of the dog. So the interesting thing is that if in nature, if in the wild, a wolf would benefit by being very small, say Chihuahua-sized, then the fastest way to get that shape is by breaking the same gene that dog breeders selected to get small dogs. So there's no reason to think that nature would have any better luck at shaping animals than our dog breeders have. And the fastest way, the easiest way to get a particular trait is to break a gene that's that in the absence of that gene, you will get the shape or the size or the trait that you're looking for.
Right. Well, fascinating. We're up against a break, Dr. Behe, so let's take that real quick, and then we'll be back and talk about actually something Darwin himself said that would basically cause his theory to be disproven or would break it down. So we'll talk about that in just a minute when we get back from the break. I want to leave with a quote from one of your books. In Darwin's time, all of biology was a black box. Not only the cell or the eye or digestion or immunity, but every biological structure and function, because ultimately no one could explain how biological processes occurred. And so I just want to remind the listener that in Darwin's day, he didn't know about DNA. He didn't know about any of these mechanisms that I just spoke of, the eye and digestion and immunity. It was all a black box. It was all a big undiscovered wonderment, really. The cell itself wasn't even really known. So just want to remind listeners that this theory came about at a time when there so much was unknown, but today we do know a lot. And when we get back, we'll talk about these complex molecular machines. I call them nanotechnology already designed into our body is what it seems like, these DNA mechanisms and the bacteria flagellum and different things. So when we get back from the break, we'll dive deeper into that, and we'll talk about what Darwin himself said would disprove his theory. So y'all stick with us. We're talking with Dr. Michael Behe, his book or books, Darwin's Black Box, The Edge of Evolution, and Darwin Dissolves. I highly encourage y'all to check those out. MichaelBehe.com is the website. I'm Ben Edwards. You're The Cure. We'll be right back. All right, everybody, welcome back. We're with Dr. Michael Behe from Lehigh University. Excited to have you here with us, Dr. Behe, talking about your work that basically not only questioned Darwin, but I would say disproves Darwin's theory of evolution. And I say that because I'm going to quote from Charles Darwin's book, The Origin of Species. Darwin himself said, quote, "If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down," end quote. That's Charles Darwin from his book, Origin of Species. Dr. Behe, explain to the listener, maybe in a little more layman's terms, what was he saying, and have we found that?
Yeah, that's a great question. In that quote, Darwin, that was the end of a section a subsection of his book he titled Organs of Extreme Complexity and Complication. So one objection to his theory is that, well, you know, how can you possibly build something as elegant as the eye in very tiny, small steps? And Darwin always insisted that his idea of evolution had to be very, very gradual. It had to proceed in tiny steps that helped just a little bit and occurred over long, long periods of time. And he insisted on that because he knew that if life improved quickly in large leaps, then it would look very suspiciously like something other than randomness and chance were involved. And he was always intent to keep out any teleology from life. So that meant that natural selection had to improve everything in a little step, and if a change came along that improved things a little bit, then natural selection could favor the offspring of that organism. And then over time, more and more of the offspring would have that, and that would give a bigger population, and that could be the base for another mutation to come along and improve things a little bit again, and then again and again and again. So it was always a kind of a continuous, very, very small changes over long periods of time. But you can ask yourself, you know, well, okay, you know, let's take Darwin at his word and say, what sort of an organ or a system could not be formed by numerous successive slight modifications. And it turns out that it's just a system that needs a number of different parts or components to perform a possible function. And in Darwin's Black Box, to illustrate the concept to people, I pointed to a mousetrap, a mechanical mousetrap. And a mousetrap has a wooden base, and it's got a metal spring and other metal parts called the hammer and the holding bar and so on. And if it doesn't have all those parts, it doesn't work. You can't build a mousetrap by just starting with a little wooden piece of wood and then add one other component on and then another, because it needs all of the components to work. And I called systems like that irreducibly complex. They're complex because they need a number of different parts, and they're irreducible because if you take one of the parts away, it breaks. It's not like it works, less efficiently than before. It doesn't work at all. And it turns out that especially at the molecular level of life, there are literally machines made out of molecules. And that's one of the great discoveries of modern biology, to discover the molecular structure of life. And like many other machines, most of them are, in fact, irreducibly complex. And one good example of it that I talk about all the time, because it makes a good visual example, is something called the bacterial flagellum, which is actually an outboard motor that bacteria use to swim. And literally, it's an outboard motor. It's got a propeller in the shape of a long whip-like tail, which is spun around and around and around, and that pushes against water and pushes the bacterium forward. And the propeller is attached to the drive shaft, which is attached to a motor, which is attached to something called a stator, which clamps the motor in place in the cell membrane when it's working. And it uses a flow of acid from the outside of the cell to the inside to turn the motor, just like kind of water flowing over a dam can turn a turbine engine. And so it's got all of these parts. And if you take away the motor, if you take away the propeller, if you take away pretty much any of the parts of this molecular machine, then just like a mousetrap, it doesn't work. So it too is irreducibly complex. So it can't be made by these numerous successive slight modifications that Darwin always insisted on. And I should say that it's the very progress of science. This is it's the very progress of science that allows us to see these marvelous things. So Darwin proposed his theory kind of in the absence of knowledge about any of the molecular foundation of life, just because in his time, nobody knew anything about it. But science is learning as it progresses, starting in the 1950s when the shape of the double helical shape of DNA was first discovered, and the shape of a protein called myoglobin, which acts to store oxygen in muscles. Science has uncovered more and more and more complexity and more elegance that is extremely difficult to reconcile with Darwin's theory. And as a matter of fact, in the entire scientific community, nobody has ever proposed, or let alone conducted an experiment to test how Darwin's mechanism could build up a machine like the flagellum or a number of other examples that I talk about in Darwin's Black Box. So I think you're right that for anybody who's willing to entertain the idea, Darwin's mechanism, although it works kind of around the edges of biology, really has been falsified in regard to its ability to to construct, positively construct the systems of life.
Well, I want to shift a little bit because, and listeners, I want y'all to hopefully caught that, that basically what Dr. Behe's saying is there's multiple examples and more all the time, the more we advance in our techniques and technologies to study these molecular machines. But there's multiple examples of these machines in our body that are so complex and have multiple working parts that had to all be in place at one time for that machine to work. I mean, just think about your car. If you took the spark plug out, the entire vehicle wouldn't work. If you took out the fuel pump, the entire vehicle wouldn't work. If you took out the alternator, you can go on and on and on. You need all of these inner working parts together at the same time. And obviously, the first half of our conversation, we're talking about Darwin's theory and these mutations that devolve when you break these genes. So, I mean, I would say in science, maybe we're not supposed to be absolutely certain on something, but, and I am biased, obviously, I stated at the top of the show, I have a worldview that believes the Christian and biblical worldview. But I would say it seems so clear to me that this is a dead theory. And I know a number of scientists, I think. So that's my question is, since your book first came out, Darwin's Black Box, that was 96, I think, have scientists, maybe privately, not publicly, or maybe publicly too, are they moving off this evolutionary theory that seems absolutely, I mean, you just said there's not even one experiment, not even one publication, one scientific paper, much less 10 or 20 or 30, not even one. It just seems like this should be a totally dead, you know, that was a 19th century thought. Let's move on to the 21st century. Yeah. Have scientists moved on is what I'm in your field and in general?
Well, that's an interesting question, and there's a couple of points you have to think about. And one is that the notion of evolution as some as an unguided process, just kind of the random working out of laws of nature, that is still pretty solid in the scientific community. Not because anybody knows how it could happen, but just because it's kind of a starting assumption for everybody. So if a person in academia or who wants to get a job in academia says anything that says that sounds like they don't think that random processes, unaided, unguided natural processes could have built life, then that's pretty much the end of your career in academia. I've done just fine, mostly because I had tenure before I got into this area. You know, I'm no fool. But other folks I know have really lost their jobs, and graduate students have been kicked out of labs because it's become known that they publicly mentioned that they thought intelligent design was necessary for life. So in that regard, academia in general is still solidly on board with Darwin, or at least with materialism. But interestingly, Darwin's theory itself, I mentioned a while back that it wasn't well received by scientists in Darwin's day. They liked the idea of evolution, but they didn't think his mechanism could do what he claimed for it. And it turns out that's getting to be a more common view among biologists in academia. I would estimate that maybe even a third of practicing academic evolutionary biologists are skeptical that Darwin's theory is the major driver of life. Now, they're not intelligent design proponents like I am, but they are casting around for some other explanation and have proposed some exotic ideas. One I could mention is that something called niche theory, N-I-C-H-E, niche theory, where classic Darwinism says that, well, the environment, you know, drives the evolution of the organism, just like we talked about the finches and the polar bear and so on, that the changes in their environments drove the genes that were selected. But they said, well, if you look at other organisms, though, they actually shape the environment in which they live. For example, a cool example is termites in Africa. There are some termites that build mounds, you know, 30 feet high and more. And they build that environment, the environment in which they live. And so these folks who are questioning Darwinism say, well, is the environment driving the organism's evolution, or maybe is the organism driving the changes in the environment? And all of these things, I should say, are really pretty vague. And they point to examples which are interesting, such as these termites and a few other things, but that still do not answer the fundamental question that Darwinism can't explain either, and that is, how could an unguided process build the complex, intricate machinery of life? I mean, niche theory might be interesting in regard to termites, but it's real hard to see how it would explain the bacterial flagellum or the eye or any other complex biological structure. Nonetheless, the point is that a large chunk of biologists are, you know, publicly bad-mouthing Darwin's theory and casting around for another idea. But because of taboos in academia, they do not, try to stay as far away from intelligent design as they can. But I think that'll change in due course, but we'll see.
Well, last question, I think. I'll try to keep it to the last question. And just a personal opinion question. Why do you think, besides the threat of being fired or losing a grant or just being ostracized as a scientist, why wouldn't a scientist allow the thought or the possibility that there's some intelligent design, intelligent being? Why can't they just say, yeah, that's there, even if I maybe don't want to define it as the God of the Bible necessarily? But what's the holdup there, in your opinion?
Well, I think historically there has been bad blood between biologists and religion or churches. You know, I think there's a famous story about Thomas Huxley, who was a friend of Darwin's and a supporter, debating an Anglican bishop, Samuel Wilberforce, soon after Darwin's book came out. And the Church of England kind of poo-pooed evolution, and so it was written up as, you know, religion was trying to circumscribe science and tell science what it could or couldn't do. And so a lot of scientists have been defensive. You know, you look at the Scopes trial and so on, and worry that they will have to follow the dictates of theology rather than their own best guesses as to what is going on. I think that idea is vastly overblown, and I also think it gets kind of tangled up with cultural issues, especially in the United States. But I think that's one driving factor, that is the history of kind of bad blood between religion and biology in particular.
Yeah, I can see that. Well, I think you're a brave scientist, a brave man, human being, for allowing yourself, I mean, I would call you a seeker of truth when you read that book and started to have honest questions and you pursued it, even knowing that it may lead to some consequences that could affect your reputation, your career. So thank you for your work and for, I would say, giving lots of some hope to people who do believe in God and do believe in intelligent design, that there's a really smart PhD published author who can support that belief. So thank you for all you've done.
Sure. Yeah, people should realize that the actual results of science, especially in the past 100 years, are strongly supportive of the notion that something outside of nature is necessary to explain nature, some intelligence outside of nature. And it's really crazy, I think, that the actual results have been spun as saying that science is somehow making religious views less believable. I think it's the very opposite.
I would agree. When I read your books and other books on this topic, that's what it did for me. It actually affirmed my beliefs and affirmed my faith and just solidified it greatly. So thank you for helping me personally to solidify my faith. And I think for thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of others too. Okay. Well, of the three books, okay, this really is my last question, and you can punt if you want. But if someone wanted to start, the three books, again, everybody, Darwin's Black Box, and then Darwin Devolves, and then The Edge of Evolution, and all those can be found at michaelbehe.com, and that is Behe, B as in boy, E-H-E, michaelbehe.com. Which of those three would you recommend first, Dr. Behe?
Well, I would recommend Darwin's Black Box, the first one I wrote, because it describes the molecular level of life. And a lot of people think, you know, cells and stuff are just gooey, nondescript things. And it shows or gives a hint of all of the complexity and regulation and so on that exists. And it tells people what needs to be explained.
Right. Well, thank you again for standing up for the truth and for being inquisitive and going, following wherever the truth may lead and making these books.
Thanks very much. It was a lot of fun this hour talking with you.
All right. Well, continue on in your quest for truth and would love to have you back on the show someday. So everybody, check out michaelbehe.com. Thanks for listening today. We'll be back next week with another great show. I'm Ben Edwards, and you're the cure.